We will begin with the roll call. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Co-Chair Lazick?
Here.
Co-Chair Bowie?
Here.
Senators Darling is excused. Fitzgerald?
Here.
Gudex? Miller excused. Moulton? Petrowski? Risser? Schilling?
Here.
Senator Taylor is excused. Senator Weingard?
Here.
Representatives August? Barca? No. Barca? Nodal?
No.
Mason? Murtha? Nygren is excused. Shanklin? Steinecke and Taylor excused. Boss?
Okay, a quorum is present. The first item on our agenda will be to approve the minutes of the February 11th meeting. Is there a motion? Motion by Senator Weingard to approve the February 11th meeting, second by Senator Schilling. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved. You have information in your packets, and we will have presentations today about each of the agenda items. And we're going to start with the Study Committee on Transfer of Structured Settlement Payments. And Representative Jim Ott is with us. Come forward, please. And Representative Walks, the Vice Chair, is with us this morning also. Welcome. And of course, Ledge Council is with us. Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Baldwig, Lazick, and committee members. Thank you for considering the final report on the transfer of structured settlements. First, I'd like to thank my co-chair, Representative Dana Walks, for his valuable insight and firsthand experience in this area of law, Senator Taylor and other committee members for their excellent contributions, and Legislative Council staff attorneys Anna Henning and Brian Larson for their hard work and guidance during this project. I firmly believe that we would not have such an outstanding report before us without the work of Anna and Brian. The need for a bill relating to the transfer of structured settlements was first raised by the Wisconsin Judicial Council during one of our regular monthly meetings. Currently, Wisconsin does not have statutes related to structured settlements, forcing judges in our state to rely on case law and the statutes of other states in approving these arrangements. This results in inconsistent practices across our court system for the approval of transfers of settlements. Given the complexity and technical nature of this area of law, the Judicial Council members believe this would be an ideal project for a study by the Joint Legislative Council Study Committee. A typical structured settlement is an agreement made by a plaintiff who has won a lawsuit, and then rather than accepting a payment schedule from a defendant who may not be able to pay their obligation all at once, will sell the judgment to a third party for a reduced amount. The defendant will then be making payments to the third party, and the plaintiff will receive a lump sum payment, although for less than the total amount of the judgment. Some of the questions raised by these arrangements are, should judges have some guidelines to follow to ensure that plaintiffs are not taken advantage of by signing away much of their judgment in order to receive an attractive looking lump sum payment? Should adult parents and guardians be allowed to enter into structured settlements on behalf of minor children? And how much disclosure information should be required of those who purchase structured settlements from plaintiffs? Over this past summer and fall, the Legislative Council Study Committee on the Transfer of Structured Settlements heard testimony from numerous interested parties, and all were in unanimous agreement that Wisconsin will benefit from having our own law. I believe the final product strikes a fair balance of protecting sellers of structured settlements without making the process so onerous that transferring a settlement would be nearly impossible. And we do have a model law on the transfer of structured settlements, and most states kind of structure their laws after the model law. Our Wisconsin law is kind of modeled after the model law, but we do have some significant differences relative to our own state. I would point out that some states, New York, California, and Oregon have laws that deviate significantly from the model law, and in some of those states, it's nearly impossible to get a transfer of a structured settlement transfer approved because there are such high hurdles to achieve. I believe our proposed law in Wisconsin, as you'll see in the final report, really does strike a fair balance. And I will turn it over to my co-chair, Representative Walks.
Thank you. And I'd like to say it was a pleasure indeed to work with Jim, Representative Ott, on this bill. And I have to say that this process has been quite refreshing, because functionally what we've done is we've all sat down together with parties that have interests in one form or another in coming to a resolution of this, of the problems that we have in this state by not having a statute on this. So it was refreshing. We worked together, Democrat, Republican, Independent, and the like, and came up with a formulation that we believe is superior to any other laws in the United States with regard to this particular problem. If it's with your indulgence, I'd like to talk a little bit about what are the day-to-day ramifications of structured settlements, why we have historically gotten involved with structured settlements, and where the system sits at this time. I remember in the late 80s, I've been practicing law since 85, and I remember in the late 80s, really one of my first significant cases, a gentleman was severely injured, and a large sum of money was turned over to him after it was determined by a jury that he was not at fault for this accident, and that he would not be able to work again as he had prior to the accident. A few weeks later, I'm crossing the street in downtown Eau Claire, and this gentleman drives by in an exceedingly expensive vehicle. And at that point, I started thinking, you know, that's really not what the purpose of that money was. The purpose of that money was to try to make sure that his future earnings would be compensated for the rest of his life. So in the 80s and 90s, structured settlements were used on a regular basis. Interest rates were such that it was conducive for structured settlements. What are the advantages of structured settlements? Functionally, what they do is they obviously give you structure so that a person is getting payments over time. Often, more often than not, those payments represent monies that are going to need to be paid for medical costs, monies that are going to need to be paid for specialized vehicles for these people. Many of these people are in wheelchairs. Many are very severely injured. And so we're able to functionally plan the life of these folks out in a fiscally conservative way so that there's money that's available to them over time as their life progresses. The other benefit of structured settlements is that if the annuities are purchased by the insurance company prior to the money being received by the plaintiff, then in that event, there's a tax advantage. There's no income tax on the gain. So the money over time is more powerful because it's invested in an annuity. There's not income tax taken out of it because it's for compensation purposes. It's not income. We usually get involved in a structured settlement when there's an injured child. That's typically when this comes about, because this person is going to have a lifetime of expenses, a lifetime of needs because of their injuries. That's typically when it happens, but it's not always in that circumstance. It's a practice at our law firm that we will bring an economist in prior to the resolution of a case. We'll bring an economist in. In fact, that economist gave testimony in our hearing. Dr. Fred Kolb is one of them. Dr. Thomas Kemp is another that we use. They come in, explain the power of money to the clients, and explain to them the tax implications of the decision that they're making. This is in order to get these folks to understand these decisions prior to the time they're made. Now, this bill addresses the situation where somebody wants to cash in their future annuity payments. The question then is, what is the information that's necessary for the person to make a knowledgeable decision about whether or not to cash in this annuity? And these, we've talked in great detail in the hearings about the information that needs to be disclosed. But one of the reasons I said earlier that our bill is actually superior, in my opinion, to many of the states' bills, perhaps all, is that there have been some changes in Medicare requirements for future set-asides. And these changes are still fluid. They're not even completely determined at this point. And if the Medicare implications aren't assessed by the judge at the time of an annuity purchase, a factoring, it's possible for the plaintiff in that situation to basically trip some tripwires, which would cost them potentially the ability to recover any medical expenditures from Medicare for the rest of their life. They could accidentally hit a wire that would cause them to lose federal benefits, even if those benefits are not related to the injury. So we built into this statute a requirement that the judge, you know, the requirement that this, that annuities for future medical set-asides not be included as a portion for factoring, that they can't sell that portion of an annuity. It's for the benefit of everybody, taxpayer, plaintiff, everybody. So I think we have a superior bill. It's been a pleasure working on this. Ledge Council have been diligent and done enormous amounts of research, and this has truly been a pleasure.
I would just add also that if a structured settlement under federal law, if that transfer is not approved by a judge, there's like a 40% federal tax liability that's placed upon the transfer. So obviously, if someone wants to sell one of these settlements or purchase it, it's definitely in their interest to have it approved by a judge. And if you don't have a law in your own state that gives the court guidance on your own law, they either have to look to the law of other states or else they have to look to case law. And so we do have two judges that sit on the Judicial Council, and both of those judges were a part of the committee that Ledge Council put together. And as a result, we've got some very good guidance and very good approval from the judges that this is the way to go to have our own law. And we'd take any questions, and Ledge Council will answer them for you.
Any questions from anyone on structured settlements? Senator Rizzo?
Yeah. As an attorney, I'm familiar with structured settlements. I've had several in my practice. My question is this. You say the court has to approve the structured settlement. Does the court have to approve the terms into the extent of the discount and the interest that might be paid? Do they go into the discount?
Under federal law, what the court needs to do in terms of approving an agreement is find that the agreement is in the best interest of the person who is the current recipient of those payments, and also their dependents, and that it does not contravene any federal or state statute, and there isn't a standard for looking in detail at the financial terms. But the financial terms, of course, become part of that consideration about whether something is in someone's best interest.
My follow-up on that question. Could the court say that the proposed contract between the person who's paying the lump sum and the patient is unreasonable and cut the whole thing out? I mean, does the court have the power to negate the possible agreement?
Yes, they do. Some states have added a reasonableness standard. Our committee, this committee, decided not to go that route. They have kept the federal standards that are required and not added anything additional. What the committee has done in the bill is add several considerations that a court may take into account when deciding whether the transfer agreement is in a payee's best interest. And among those considerations, the court may consider the financial terms in the agreement.
My final question is, there's no guidelines as to what is reasonable. It's up to the court. In other words, you don't have any, one court could come up with different guidelines than another court. Is it, I mean, there's no specific guidelines, are there? In other words, what would keep court one from coming up with a understanding of a one-third discount, another court saying, well, one-fourth discount? I mean, what is there statewide standard?
Yeah, Senator Risser, I think what the intent and purpose of this bill is to make sure that people are fully advised of what the implications are of what they're doing. What this bill addresses is the situation where somebody's coming in to trade in the annuities for their structured settlement. And, you know, that it, at some point for those folks that are competent, it does become, you know, they have a property right in their own money as well. I mean, so it does become at some point they're having to make a decision. The question is, are they given enough information to make a knowledgeable decision, functionally an informed consent of what they're going to do? And we believe that this bill allows people to get enough information that they can knowledgeably understand the terms of, you know, the implications of what they're doing. Now, if somebody's disabled, that's a different thing.
Also, there are, I think, 8 disclosures that are required in the model bill. The bill that we are intending to introduce for Wisconsin has 3 additional disclosures so that the people who are selling the settlements know exactly what they're getting into. And obviously, it's kind of confusing when you take $500,000 and you say, we're going to sell this right to this money to someone over an extended period of time. You've come in with interest rates, payments, the length of time. So I think the disclosures are giving protection to the seller so that they know what they're doing.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Ballweg.
I just wanted to say thank you to the two gentlemen who were the chairs of this. I think we're very fortunate, and it worked out very well that you were here and are so interested and knowledgeable in this topic. And, you know, obviously you've researched it quite well, and I'm confident that what you're bringing forward is the right thing. So just thank you very much for the work you've all done on this.
I have to say we had some great expertise as members of the public who are on the committee, and they provided some real guidance as well. And we had testimony, very excellent testimony from interested parties on what the bill should and shouldn't include.
Okay. Representative Barca.
Just 2 quick things. First of all, you caught my attention, Representative Watts, in terms of you're saying that with Medicare, they're changing the rules now. I mean, so is there, as you look at this long term, I mean, what are the implications for us?
I believe, if I remember correctly, it's on page 7 of the bill that we, near the bottom of the page, what we've done is alert the judges to the fact that annuities that are intended to serve as future medical expenses related to the accident or the malpractice or whatever the situation, those are not to be factored. Those annuities are not to be sold whatsoever. The judges, now the dickens of this situation is that, you know, it's very rare for a judge to be faced with this situation. So what we're doing with this statute is alerting the judges to the fact that you know, the section 1395YB of the federal statutes needs to be addressed. We're telling the judges, take a look in here and make sure that there isn't an annuity that is to pay for future medical expenses.
Okay.
We're giving notice to the judges, and we don't know for sure what the Medicare, they haven't fully formulated their review of these situations. They are in the process of doing it, but it's that just in and of itself that
question as to what they're going to do is causing a lot of trouble within the civil litigation industry, because nobody knows exactly what they're going to do. So what we did is we built in really notifying the judges that be sure to ask questions about 1395Y.
And secondly, just briefly, I noticed initially came out of Judicial Council, which I know is being proposed for elimination of the budget. I mean, what are the, any thoughts on that?
I am doing my best to get the funding for the Judicial Council restored. I think a lot of members of the legislature are not aware of the work the Judicial Council does. We have 21 members. It's enshrined in statutes. We have a designee from the Supreme Court. We have judges, attorneys, prosecutors, members of the public are appointed to this council. We are going to have a bill coming forward later this summer, which is a revision of the Criminal Procedure Code. It's Assembly Bill 90.
Right.
It's already out there. And this is largely a product of the Judicial Council.
Right, right.
Worked for a number of years on this. The suggestion for this structured settlement bill came out of the Judicial Council.
Right.
And as I said, two of the judges that sit on the council were also members of our committee. So my feeling is the Judicial Council does excellent work. It's largely volunteer work, except for one paid staff member, and I think the total amount in the budget is $130,000. So I am making a strong case wherever I can that this money should be restored, because I think it's a real bargain for the state that we get this kind of volunteer service from the community. And we meet on a monthly basis from September through June, and they do a lot of other work on court rules and so on. I've been sitting on this committee for the last 4 years, the council of the last 4 years, as chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Assembly. And so I highly recommending and doing everything I can to see that that $130,000 is restored.
Good. Senator Woodard.
William, my thanks as well. I think you guys did a comprehensive job, and nice to see this package move forward in such a bipartisan unanimous methodology. So good work.
Senator Woodard.
I would add also, as a co-member of the council, I'd ask my colleagues to support restoration of that through this budget process also. You can't believe what they actually do on the council. It's unbelievable, the cost that it's eliminating. My question deals with the Medicare future set-asides. Are there other areas that are also set aside specifically in this that would protect, say, dependent children or something such as that that have to be considered, or is it just kind of a cursory thing that the judge should look at this type thing?
In terms of the standards, the standard that requires the court to evaluate the effect of the transfer agreement on the payee and also the payee's dependents will get at that effect on dependence issue. In terms of other specific considerations, one of the considerations that the bill includes that a court may make when deciding whether something is in the best interest is whether the payee is delinquent in the payment of taxes in this state, and also delinquent in any restitution order in a criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding. So those are considerations and also a child support order. So those are considerations that the committee felt that courts should be taking into account when they're evaluating these agreements.
And those are set up specifically in this legislation?
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you.
Representative Knodel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. I just wonder if you can help me understand how this process comes to be after a judgment is settled on and this individual leaves the courthouse. You know, is there a guy in a trench coat with an attaché full of cash waiting to make a deal? I mean, we got reputable firms here. How do they connect?
Here's how it typically works. Cases of significance, more often than not, they settle prior to trial. And at the time that those final settlement discussions are happening, that is the time when we bring economists in to start talking with people about whether or not to accept a structure. The plaintiff can't accept the money. They can't have constructive receipt of the money without tax implications. So the decision to have a structure is typically prior to any settlement.
And so we start talking about annuities and talking about payments. Then we typically have our economists really figure out what the present value of that is. Used to be very structured, and or used to be very rigid that we weren't allowed to say what the money really is, the present value at the time of the settlement. We had economists on both sides of it working it out. We still keep economists involved heavily. So what happens is after the case is finished, I mean, after a structure is purchased, and if there's a minor involved or a disabled person mentally, then there has to be an approval of it by the courts. After that process is done, the client is pretty much on their own. And at that point in time, there's some companies that advertise on television, you know, it's your money, get it now. It's at that point that the company makes an offer to purchase their annuities. And there have been some tragic situations. I am unaware of any of my clients having made a decision to do this, but we don't always know because, you know, I just got a call actually last week from a client that I represented about, I don't know, about 15, 20 years ago in a very, well, in a medical negligence case. And that client called to just to touch base and say how well things are working, that those medical expenses are being paid over time, that the system is working. So I think most people leave these things alone. I can't speak directly to any of my clients that have actually factored or sold their structures. I have heard, however, horror stories among folks in the bar. You know, I have heard stories of suddenly somebody buying a whole pile of snowmobiles and things of that nature. And so there needs to be a disclosure to these folks, just what are the implications of what they're doing. I think it's a total win-win for everybody, taxpayer, plaintiff, insurance company alike, to make sure that these disclosures are made.
And the temptation to a plaintiff who has received a large reward and they know they're going to be getting $1 million spread out over the next 20 years, somebody comes along and says, you know what, I'm going to give you $75,000 hard cold cash right in your hand right now. You don't have to wait. And sometimes that temptation is too great and the person makes a very bad decision. And obviously it's their decision and we can only do so much to protect people from bad decisions. But there is a balance someplace in there where again, you know, we don't want to outlaw structured settlements because some people make bad decisions because some people really benefit by them and they do need the cash up front and they do get a reasonable payment. But so there's the what we did in this committee, and I think what the final product of the committee does is does strike a balance. There is going to be disclosure, there are going to be protections, there is going to be judicial oversight. Judges are going to have guidance on a law that's in Wisconsin statutes, and at the same time, it's not going to be so difficult to get a structured settlement that virtually none of them happen because you're not really benefiting the person who this is their property, and so we don't want to tell them you cannot do this with your property, but we want to make sure that they're not being hoodwinked into something that is, you know, totally unconscionable.
Representative Mason.
Thank you. I too would like to join my colleagues in thanking you and Ledge Council staff for the work you did in putting this together. I have unfortunately had the J.G. Wentworth commercial jingle going on in my head the entire time that you've been giving this presentation, and it won't stop. So I'm hoping you can explain, just to follow up on Representative Knoedl's questions and the answers, which help, but trying to get at whether or not structured settlements make sense, it sounds like there's not a one-size-fits-all answer to that question. But when they do the structured settlement, is there something in this bill that makes sure that the terms of those structured settlements are fair and don't seem like, you know, the predatory lending practices we see in other arenas that are objectionable in many ways? Is there something in here that makes sure that these structured settlements are fair for the person selling them?
What we're doing here is
trying to define what are the important things to make sure a person who's selling their structure for a lump sum understand before they do it. You know, at some point, people do have property value in their own money. So, I mean, if somebody's hell-bent on making a terrible decision, the court isn't going to be able to stop it. But they're going to make sure that the person understands what the present value discounted or the present value of that what they're giving away is and what they're getting in response to it. There are sometimes situations where people need to get out of a structure. I can't remember. There was testimony, I believe, in our committee where somebody had to get a van specially configured for disability, and there was some kind of a problem that led to their having to get it right now because something had happened. I mean, there are situations where there really is no one-size-fits-all in this thing. I mean, it just, you have some situations where, like the person that called me a couple days ago, where they have thousands of dollars a month in medical expenses that need to be addressed, and that's for their whole life. So in those situations, and that's a mentally disabled person as a result of the injury as well, so in those situations, a court would very highly scrutinize somebody coming in and trying to cash in those annuities. They would be very intense scrutiny. Probably it'd be very difficult to get that done, frankly. But yeah, there's no one size fits all. But the problem is, in our state, we had no law at all. And so what happens is people come in with a structured settlement, and I believe Texas and New York law was most often applied. I can't remember the testimony exactly, but so a Wisconsin judge has, because of the conflicts of law, the way conflicts of law works, a Wisconsin judge has to take the contractual state of that contract and look at their law as to how to go about it. And you got all comers in terms of what other states require, some just about nothing. And this, I think, is a pretty good law. I think we've crafted something that makes a lot of sense. And I'm almost positive ours is the only one that addresses the changing future Medicare requirements. I think we're the only one that does that.
And we should mention that these transfers are happening in Wisconsin right now. They happen every year. Of course, judges are operating, as Representative Walk said, on other states' laws and on case law. And as far as protecting the seller, that's going to be up to the judge who makes the approval of the sale. And if the judge sees something there that's wrong or out of line, it'll be up to the judge to present to the parties, this isn't going to work. And now the judge will have our own law to use as guidance.
Okay, Senator Rizzo, a follow-up? Okay. Seeing no further questions, we thank you very much for your work, your endurance test, serving on the committee and doing all the homework. Thank you to you. Thank you to Ledge Council. We appreciate that. And then we have a motion from Senator Rizzer to approve LRB 0731/1. Seconded by Representative Barca. Any other discussion or questions? Okay, would the clerk please call the roll?
Co-Chair Lozick?
Aye.
Co-Chair Bowie?
Aye.
Senators Fitzgerald is aye. Gudex? Moulton?
Aye.
Risser?
Aye.
Schilling? Wongard?
Aye.
Representatives August?
Aye.
Barca?
Aye.
Knodel?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Murtha?
Aye.
Shanklin?
Aye.
Speaker Voss?
We have 13 ayes. It is approved.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move on to agenda item 2, report of the study committee on the review of criminal penalties. Representative Rob Hutton, chair, and David Moore and Mike Quinslan, Ledge Council staff. And Representative Spiros, thank you for joining us.
good morning, and thank you to the legislative, Joint Legislative Council. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning, having chaired the study committee on criminal penalties and the opportunity to present those findings and the result of work that that committee did this summer. I appreciate the work done by Mike and Dave as they provided counsel along the way in directing the process of the study. And I'd just like to recognize a couple of members who served on that study committee with me this summer. Senator Risser was our Senate representative on the study committee. So, Senator, thank you for the work you did and for your availability and your expertise. And the gentleman to my left, Representative Spiros, who also chaired one of our subcommittees and did a lot of the heavy lifting getting us to the point of conclusion at the end of the committee. So I appreciate not only his background as a legislator, but as a professional in the business world, as well as a former law officer, brought a unique perspective to his role in the committee. So thank you for that. I'll just read my overall summary, and then we will obviously open up to questions by the joint committee. And I've directed Rep. Spiros to be the recipient of all difficult, critical questions, and Mike can fill in with the remainder of those. So, good morning, Joint Legislative Council. It was my pleasure to serve as chair of the study committee on the review of criminal penalties this summer. I'm here today to describe the bill draft the committee has recommended for introduction by the Joint Legislative Council. The committee was directed to review the penalties for misdemeanor and low-level felony offenses. Specifically, the committee was directed to determine whether current misdemeanor or low-level felony penalties are appropriate, whether any crimes should be classified that aren't currently classified, and whether any offenses are outdated or should be decriminalized. Along with several legislators, the committee's membership included three judges, a district attorney, the director of the Department of Justice's Office of Criminal Victim Services, two defense attorneys, a law professor, and the adjunct to the Milwaukee County Sheriff. Professional experience and judgment these public members brought to the committee were invaluable in crafting a piece of legislation that fulfills the task for which the committee was charged. The committee also heard from various criminal justice professionals and other stakeholders throughout the course of its study. These individuals included a law professor, a district attorney, the director of state courts, a county sheriff, a court of appeals judge, and numerous state agency staff. Over the course of the study, the great lengths to which the input was sought became the committee's hallmark. To accomplish our assignment, we created two subcommittees to work on particular aspects of the study committee's scope and make recommendations to the full study committee. First, we tasked the subcommittee on obsolete and misdemeanors with identifying misdemeanor offenses that may be repealed because they are no longer relevant or are obsolete. Second, we directed the subcommittee on penalty alignment and organization to make recommendations about aligning misdemeanor penalties so that crimes of similar severity have similar penalties, and to determine whether any unclassified misdemeanors should be classified, and lastly, to identify misdemeanors that the study committee might consider either reducing to a forfeiture or elevating to a felony. And Representative Spiros was kind enough to chair that portion of the study committee. The leadership of Representative Nyland and Representative Spiros, the chair of the two subcommittees, were instrumental in developing the committee's final product. In response to testimony and based on the professional experiences shared by its members, the committee recommends LRB-1635/1 for introduction. This bill draft makes the following four changes. First, the bill draft classifies the majority of unclassified misdemeanors in the Wisconsin statutes. Under current law, misdemeanor offenses in the criminal code are classified as a Class A, B, or C misdemeanor, each with a corresponding maximum fine and term of imprisonment. The bill draft uses these three classes to organize most unclassified misdemeanor offenses, that is, misdemeanors located outside of the criminal code. The committee's decision to classify these offenses made the task of determining the appropriate penalties easier for the committee and will afford future legislatures the same benefit. In developing principles to guide the classification of misdemeanors, the committee made it a priority to defer to prior legislation, I'm sorry, to prior legislative determinations about the severity of offenses. In addition, the committee decided not to classify or otherwise affect the penalties for crimes related to OWI, drug offenses, crimes related to elections and public officials, crimes related to public assistance, crimes related to mining, crimes related to federally delegated environmental protected programs, and various other misdemeanor offenses. Second, the bill draft repeals misdemeanors identified by the committee as obsolete or no longer relevant. Examples of this type of crime, crimes related or crimes that relate to obsolete technology, such as telegraphs and corn shredders. Why we use those two examples, I have no idea. They were relevant at the time, right, Mike? According to the data provided by the Office of the Director of State Courts, none of the crimes repealed have been charged for at least the last 10 years. Third, the bill draft changes the penalty for certain misdemeanors to civil forfeitures. Most of these misdemeanors are offenses currently punishable by fine only, not by a term of imprisonment. The bill draft generally changes the penalty for an offense punishable by a fine of a certain amount to a forfeiture of that same amount. Finally, the bill draft addresses two important issues related to forfeiture prosecutions that were raised by law enforcement, district attorneys, and judges during the study committee. First, current law only authorizes a law enforcement officer to issue a citation for a select forfeiture offenses. Second, under current law, the civil procedure rules of discovery apply to most types of forfeiture prosecutions. The bill draft resolves these issues by authorizing law enforcement officers to issue a citation for any civil forfeiture offense and by applying the criminal procedure rules of discovery to certain forfeiture offenses initiated by a citation. As some of you remember from the last session, members of the Joint Committee on Finance inserted a provision in the last budget requesting Joint Legislative Council create this study committee. The bill draft before you honors this request and represents months of hard work completed through the unique study committee process where legislators collaborate with informed public members. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Mike Queensland of the Legislative Council, who staffed the committee with David Moore, is also available to answer questions. Thank you for hearing my comments today. Before I open up to questions, if I could, just for clarification, and you will read in the review the results of the ballots that were sent in, that we ultimately had 13 members vote in support of the legislation, two that did not cast a vote. One was Representative Barnes, who did not vote. The other one was DA Adam Jarrell. Subsequent to that, Adam Jarrell did respond via email that although he was not able to vote or cast a ballot, he does support the draft before you this morning.
Thank you. Representative Spiros, did you want to add anything?
My only addition would be just that I think that Legislative Council did a great job, even on our subcommittees, and the public members as well as those representatives really came together, as well as a lot of the public officials that came in and testified. So it was a very good group, a lot of openness, and we got to a conclusion pretty fast. But we listened to what those judges and prosecutors and others had to say in reference to things, and really took their dialogue and took their recommendations to heart. So, but really from the leadership of Representative Hutton, I think it was a very good committee.
Thank you. We appreciate, and I can understand and appreciate the tedious work after looking through the document showing the crimes that you dealt with. So we really appreciate all that tedious work. Senator Risser.
Madam Chair, thank you. As Vice Chairman of the committee, you know, no legislation is perfect. And this is not a perfect bill. Let me commit that. It's not a perfect bill. But overall, in my opinion, it's an improvement. If, for instance, it does, as pointed out, repeal provisions of statutes that haven't been used for years and years and years. There's no reason why we shouldn't get that out of there. And secondly, and this is one thing that helped convince me to support it, overall, when you look at the misdemeanors, overall, we reduced rather than increased the sentencing. If you take the whole complex, I think that it's good public policy and the decisions we made. As I say, this isn't a perfect bill, but overall, it does reduce, it does provide for citations and forfeitures, an increase, and does eliminate some obsolete provisions. So I think that while it's not perfect, it's worth moving ahead and letting the legislature review. Thank you.
Representative Knodel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, gentlemen, for your work here, and I'm going to apologize ahead of time for this question, perhaps. But my curiosity's just been piqued here. Under your list of the obsolete misdemeanors, you have endurance contests. And I'm just curious what endurance contests were misdemeanors. 175,
15. As far as getting to the specifics of that statute, I don't have it in front of me. It did come up in the course of conversation in the Subcommittee on Obsolete Misdemeanors, which was headed up by Representative Nealon. That was brought up by, I believe, Joe Kurofsky of the Department of Justice, who noted that in all likelihood, that statute probably could be applied to Ironman competitions and things like that, outlawing sort of behaviors like that. Perhaps it was originally intended for something different than that, but in any case, there was a consensus in the subcommittee level on that specific provision that it hadn't been used in, like all the other misdemeanors that are appealed under the bill, hadn't been used in over 10 years, this one probably likely ever, and that it likely prohibits activities that are generally accepted by Wisconsin.
Okay, I'm safe then. I'm an Ironman in a little bit.
Okay, any other questions? Seeing none.
I have one.
Senator, Representative Barca.
There's a lot of good ones in here. You know, time of filing endorsed on telegrams delivered. That's one that we really got to worry about. Or failure to use standard time, or you mentioned the one about the abolition of corn shredders purchased before 1909. You guys must have had a blast on this committee.
we had fun reminiscing, let's put it that way.
Thank you. Thanks for your work.
Okay. Seeing Senator Hicklin. Representative.
Thank you. Oh, this is, I pressed it. Hopefully you guys can hear me. First, I want to thank you for going through so many different department recommendations and then using really good judgment. I noticed that the DOR suggested taking off the requirement for sales tax and having a penalty related to not showing sales tax, and I appreciate you retaining that. So I think it's really important. My question is related to the two Citizens Utility Board parts of the obsolete misdemeanors that will be repealed. Could you just explain that to me?
In the course of the work of the Subcommittee on Obsolete Misdemeanors, the subcommittee requested input from state agencies, and one of the agencies that responded to that request was the PSC. And in a letter that they submitted to the committee, they mentioned that Chapter 199, I believe it is, of the statutes relates to the Citizens Utility Board, and that it reflects that in the past, that board had been regulated. It had been, I guess, created under the state law, but since then, the board has been moved to a private nonprofit organization. So the structure provided by that entire chapter really is not relevant here, with the exception of maybe one definition in that entire chapter. So the subcommittee looked at that recommendation and decided ultimately to just remove the criminal penalties that they believed were obsolete, rather than the rest of the chapter, which they thought would be better left for the legislature to take up at another time.
Okay, that explains it. Thank you very much.
Senator Weingard.
Just a quick question. I'm looking at civil forfeiture procedures, and I see here that law enforcement officers can initiate civil forfeiture actions by issuing a citation using the process provided, blah, blah, blah. What was the difference? What was the main change going to the criminal procedures for rules of discovery?
So this issue was raised by a number of DAs, law enforcement, and judges on our committee and outside of our committee as well. The issue being that for a lot of forfeiture actions, the ones that we're probably most familiar with, like a traffic ticket, another example that came up was an underage drinking violation. Law enforcement has the authority to initiate those proceedings by writing out...
EMCC.
Right. They can write out that citation, give it to the person, and that initiates the process. So one of the things that the bill does is it allows law enforcement to use that same process or use a similar process to that to initiate proceedings for forfeiture actions for all of those forfeitures that are not currently specified to have that authority. So we have specific authority currently for example, traffic violations and for underage drinking, but we don't have it for probably most of the other forfeitures that are out there. So it provides that authority. The second thing that it does is it addresses the issue of discovery. So for certain forfeitures, we have a specified rules of discovery that apply to them. But we've had court rulings, very recent ones actually, that say if there's not a specific provision that provides what the discovery rules are for a civil forfeiture action, that the civil rules of procedure that govern discovery would apply rather than, say, the criminal rules of procedure. And the members of the committee felt that was significant because that would allow both sides, both the prosecuting side and the defense side, to use mechanisms that are used in civil procedure for discovery, such as interrogatories and depositions that are not typical of enforcement actions. So they felt that it was an important change to make apply the same rules of discovery as a criminal action, which has a similar enforcement mechanism to it. It did, however, leave an exception to that. If the prosecuting attorney decides to initiate that action instead of using a citation by doing it through a long-form complaint, mm-hmm. If they go that route, they cannot. That would mean that the civil rules of discovery would apply, unless there's somewhere else in the statutes some sort of specific provision that would say, in these cases, these are the rules of discovery that apply.
So this is mainly just getting it into a format that is a more usable format, plus it also establishes the availability of what reports and stuff would be available to both sides of the issue also for those regular rules of evidence.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah, there's the two pieces of it. One is allowing use of citations to initiate these actions, and the other is to providing for criminal rules of discovery
for the process
here, which would be more consistent with other enforcement actions.
Got it. Thank you.
If I could just make a follow-up comment on that.
Who was that?
That was talking for
Let me do the center. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Senator Wagner, just to add some context, when we looked at civil forfeitures into the context of what the study committee was charged to do, it really fell outside of our purview. But there was enough discussion amongst the DAs and some of the judges around that issue. We felt it was important enough to incorporate it into this subcommittee because we had some expertise that was willing to kind of carry the water on it and bring some resolve to it. And so we felt it was important to go ahead and address it here.
Good works, because that was always an issue. I'm glad to see you guys addressed it. I saw it here and I went, is this what I think it is? Mm-hmm. And it is. Thank you. Good
Great.
Work.
Thank you for your feedback.
Thank you. Okay. I think we've heard from everyone. Thank you very much for your work. Tedious work. Appreciate that. Okay. Do we have a motion to approve LRB 1635/1?
So moved.
It's moved by our co-chair, Representative Ballwig, seconded by, who didn't have a turn down there? Senator Rizzo wants to? Okay, Senator Rizzo. Discussion, all in favor, please call the roll.
Co-chair Lazek?
Aye.
Co-chair Ballwig?
Aye.
Senators Fitzgerald? Aye. Gudex? Moulton?
Aye.
Risser?
Aye.
Schilling? Wangard?
Aye.
Representatives August?
Aye.
Barca?
Aye.
Knodel?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Murtha?
Aye.
Shanklin? Foss?
14 ayes.
14 ayes. The LRB will be forwarded for introduction. Thank you. Our next item is the report of the Study Committee on State-Tribal Relations. Representative Jeff Rousseau, David Level, and David Moore with Ledge Council worked on this study committee. We have, it is in tab 4 in your booklet. And thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Co-chairs Baldwin and Lozick and council members, thank you for being here today and listening to our study committee's report that I'm going to bring forward today. I am pleased that the report and the committee's recommendations to be brought forward to you today. First, I'd like to comment briefly on the committee itself. As you know, the Joint Legislative Council is directed by statute to create this committee in each biennium. The committee consists of legislators and public members nominated by the tribe. The committee is seen by many as a very valuable tool to tribes, for tribes to raise the concerns to the legislature. I am pleased to report that the committee is functioning very well. For the second session in a row, we are seeing the highest level of participation by the tribes in recent memory. The committee includes representatives of 10 of the 11 tribes at this present time. While there are some very controversial issues that the tribes would raise, this committee is traditionally steered away from those, focusing more on the improving government functioning. It has done a lot of very good work, for example, improving law enforcement on Indian reservations and throughout northern Wisconsin. The committee is reporting three very modest recommendations to you today. The first is funding for tribal colleges. The first recommendation relates to supporting the cost of non-Indian students who attend tribal colleges. Under federal law, the Federal Bureau of Indian Education, the BIE, provides grants to tribal colleges. The amount of this grant is based on the number of full-time equivalent Indian students who are enrolled at the college. Currently, there are two tribal colleges in Wisconsin, the College of Menominee Nation and the Lakota Ray Ojibwe Community College. Both colleges enroll non-Indian and Indian students. Approximately 40% of the College of Menominee Nation student body is non-Indian, and approximately 30% of the Lakota Ray Ojibwe Community College's students' body is non-Indian. Both colleges charge non-Indian students the same tuition that they charge Indian students. The federal grants that colleges receive then pay for services the colleges provide to both Indian and non-Indian students. Though the amount of the grants is based solely on the number of full-time equivalent Indian students the colleges enroll, LRB 0359/3 provides a grant to tribal colleges to subsidize educational services the colleges provide to non-Indian students who are residents of the state. Under the bill draft, the amount that a tribal college receives for each non-Indian student is the same as the per-student amount the tribal college receives from the BIE for Indian students enrolled at the college. The bill draft provides that these grants are funded from the appropriation of the University of Wisconsin system. The second bill draft, tribal identification cards. The second recommendation relates to tribal ID cards. Various laws require a person to present identification for various purposes, for example, proof of residency for the purpose of voting, proof of age for the purchase of alcoholic beverages, proof of identity for the purpose of certain prescription drugs. LRB 0927/1 provides that an ID card issued by the federally recognized American Indian tribe or band in this state may be used as personal identification under any law that requires an individual to present personal identification if the card contains all of the following: full-time address and date of birth of the cardholder, a photograph of the cardholder, all other information required for personal identification under the law. The draft provides that if a person refuses to accept the tribal ID card as personal identification as requirement under the draft, the cardholder or the American Indian tribe or band that issued the card
may bring an action for mandamus asking a court to order the person to accept the tribal ID card as personal identification. The third item today is a recommendation relating to charter schools. The statutes provide three mechanisms by which a charter school can be established. Teachers may petition their school board to create a charter school. A school board may establish a charter school. A so-called independent authorizer may establish a charter school. The statutes establish four independent authorizers: the Common Council of the City of Milwaukee, the Chancellor of the UW-Milwaukee, on a pilot basis, the Chancellor of UW-Parkside, and the Milwaukee Area Technical College District Board. LRB 1441/1 authorizes a tribal college or one or more American Indian tribes or bands to establish and operate or initiate a contract for the operation of a charter school. The draft defines tribal college as an accredited college operated or controlled by a federally recognized American Indian tribe or band in this state. Today with me is Mr. David Lovell and also Mr. David Moore, are also our staff for our committee, and between David and I, we could answer any questions, and thank you for listening this morning to my three bills.
Thank you for your presentation, and thank you for your work on the committee. Any questions from committee members? Representative Mason?
Thank you very much for the work that you've done on the committee. I have concerns about the charter language, particularly about the funding. Does the bill do an analysis at all of what a potential charter school would mean from lost revenue for other school districts in the area and across the state?
Representative Mason, the effect would be the same as it is for any other charter school.
Right, and when those go into place, they take money away from public schools in the area and around the state.
That is correct, Representative.
Okay, I'm wondering if there's any sort of fiscal analysis that would quantify just how much
communications from the Department of Public Instruction provided to the committee indicated that it gave a table of the effect of charter school funding on individual school districts. It varies very substantially from a few hundred dollars to over $1 million. It's based on a per pupil amount. And this would just be in proportion to that, depending on the number of students who would be enrolled.
Okay. My concern about this proposal, I think the first two pieces of it are fine. I think the unfortunate thing I think that's coming out of this study is it's going to subject a lot of good work to an ongoing debate about not funding charter schools in this state and creating those different opportunities in education at the expense of current education opportunities that are already being threatened with more than $100 million in cuts this year in the governor's budget. In my view, having this part of the package is a poison pill for the bill overall, and in its current form makes it very difficult for me to be supportive. I would like to suggest constructively that perhaps reconfiguring the bill or considering the bill to be an instrumentality charter that would actually be funded through a district and part of the district and funded appropriately by lawmakers would make this a slam dunk, I think, for everybody. I think going about it this way is going to wade us into an ongoing debate that we've had around school privatization and vouchers that I think would be unfortunate. I would encourage, and I wasn't on the committee and don't want to insult any of the great work that they did, but it certainly would have been a better product and have less entanglements with that debate if we'd found a way to fund these charters appropriately and not ask public schools that are already taking more than $100 million in cuts to take another cut by exploring these avenues. Thank you.
Senator Weingard.
Madam Chair, if I could just briefly recognize, we have members of the Racine 21st Century Prep School that have visited, and they've been with us today, and they're taking part, learning about the process here, and this is one of those charter schools that's done an awesome job. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning, students, and welcome. We hope you enjoy our dialogue here today. Okay, any other Representative Knoll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of order. We're going to have three separate votes here. Each bill will be voted separate.
Okay, your question is separately or together? We had intended to vote in mass, and I think what Representative Mason suggests, I think, is a good dialogue that needs to take place at the committee when they consider the bill.
So you're expecting one vote here?
That's what we had planned. That's what we did last time, is to do them in mass. Senator Moulton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a simple question. How does the tuition in the tribal colleges compare with tuition in other colleges within the state?
I'm sorry, Senator. I don't have the tuition figures for the colleges. I have the figures regarding the funding support that's received from the BIA. There is an officer of the College of the Menominee Nation in the room if the chair would like to have a question addressed that way, but otherwise I'm afraid I don't have the answer to that question.
Senator Gudik?
I'll make a motion to approve these three bills in mass.
Okay, we have a motion to approve the bills in mass. Is there a second? Is there a second to that motion? Seconded by Senator Wongard. Any discussion? Senator Rizzo? We have a request to vote separately rather than in mass. Do you want to vote on this, or would you like to withdraw the motion to vote in mass? Or we could take this vote and then see where it goes. But we do have a motion before us. Pardon? Representative Barca.
I think that it's been a courtesy to extend to people. If people feel more comfortable voting separately, I don't see why it would make any difference. So. Obviously, there's more support for some proposals than there are for others. I do share my good colleague from Racine's comments in regard to the funding of this charter school, that I think that in the past we were able to fund these separately, but to have it come away from public schools, I think, is an issue for many of us. And I would just second the request by Senator Risser that just as a courtesy we separate the question.
Okay. Would you like to withdraw the motion, Senator Gudik, and we'll vote on each one individually?
Well, I guess I will, but I don't understand. I mean, these are going to committee anyway, so we're going to debate these in committee. Just forming out.
Yes, I share those thoughts. I thought moving it on in mass and then having those discussions in committee are a good idea.
My understanding of this proceeding is different than others, so I guess.
Yes. Yes. Okay, we will withdraw that motion. Then we have three LRBs before us. The first one, LRB 0359/3. Is there a motion to approve the first one? Seeing none. Do we have a motion on 3-5? Let's take a moment, Ledge Council. Please tell us which that LRB, what that LRB does for us.
LRB 0359/3 is the draft that provides funding assistance for the tribal colleges.
Okay, we have a motion by Representative Barca to approve 0359/3. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Co-Chair Ballwig. Okay, this one, again, I'm going to ask Ledge Council. This one is the one that funds
the...
Provides funding assistance to tribal colleges to support the cost of non-Indian students who are attending the tribal colleges.
Okay, and do we know the cost on that?
The cost is the BIA funding. This is matching. It's providing grants at the same level as the Bureau of Indian Education, which is $5,500 per student. And with the current enrollment numbers of the two colleges, would come to $2.3 million, Madam Chair.
And how is that funding, how is that paid
from
now?
From the university system, University of Wisconsin system appropriation.
It is now paid. So how would the...
How is it now paid? It's not currently paid. There is a separate funding that comes from the Federal Bureau of Indian Education, which is based on the number of Indian students enrolled in the colleges. This is providing funding that parallels that to support the cost of non-Indian students who are attending those colleges.
Okay, but right now, how is that paid for? Do they pay for it through tuition?
Currently, the colleges use the funding they receive from the BIE to cover operating expenses for all students and make up the difference in tuition.
Okay, so the non-Indian students, they have no tuition?
They pay tuition. All students pay tuition.
Okay.
The tribal students and non-tribal students pay the same tuition.
Okay. Any other discussion or questions? Co-Chair Ballweg?
Thank you. So I'm going to support this bill today, but with the understanding that we need to talk further about how this would actually be funded, that I would not be in favor of, you know, further reducing the UW subsidy, but of course that's all on the table one way or another. So I appreciate that you're trying to move this forward and have some other ideas that might supply funding and give you the opportunity to continue this discussion.
Thank you, and I would greatly appreciate that. We do have some other sources because obviously when we did this legislation, we had these drafts done. Some of the situations that we are facing right now weren't as enlightening as they are today. So we found some other different funding sources, and so we're certainly looking at amending some different situations here.
Okay. And I had intended to forward these all in mass for the committees to do more work, but given that we're not doing that, that we're breaking this apart, I do have concerns about this that I just can't address in the few moments here, so I won't be supporting it today. Mm-hmm. Representative Barca?
Vice Chair, I share Co-Chair Ballweg's concerns. I'll support it as a matter of trying to find a measure where we can find funding for this, but obviously, as you indicated, the situation has changed dramatically. So in terms of if this bill were to come to the floor with this funding device, there's no way I could support it. So I think we have to find other sources of funding so we're not, you know, taking away, you know, another tranche of money from the $300 million cuts that the UW is already sustaining. So it's sort of with that in mind, I'll go along with Co-Chair Ballweg's spirit in this.
Okay, anyone else? Senator Rizzer. Any others? Okay, would the clerk call the roll?
Co-Chair Lozick?
No.
Co-Chair Ballweg?
Aye.
Senators Fitzgerald is aye. Gudex? Moulton? Risser? Schilling?
Aye.
Wongard?
Aye.
Representatives August?
No.
Barca?
Aye.
Knodel? Mason?
No.
Murtha? Shanklin? Boss.
Okay, we have 8 ayes, 6 noes on that, so that one fails. We need 12 votes to forward something. The next LRB is 0927/1. And Ledge Council, could you tell us what that LRB does?
Yes, Madam Chair. Once again, this is a draft that would specify that a tribally issued identification card is sufficient identification under any statute that requires a person to provide personal identification as long as it includes name, address, and birth date, and a photograph of the cardholder, plus whatever other information may be required under the statute in question.
Okay. Any questions, comments from committee members? Okay. Seeing none, do we have a motion to approve 0927/1? Motion by Senator Rizzo, seconded by Representative Barca. Any discussion? Okay, would the clerk please call the roll?
Co-Chair Lozick?
Aye.
Co-Chair Bolling?
Aye.
Senators Fitzgerald is aye. Gudix?
Aye.
Moulton?
Aye.
Risser?
Aye.
Schilling?
Aye.
Weingard?
Aye.
Representatives August?
Aye.
Barca?
Aye.
Knodel?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Murtha?
Aye.
Shanklin? Boss.
Motion. We have 14 ayes. That is sufficient. That LRB will move forward. Thank you. And third, we have LRB 1441/1. Legislative Council, could you tell us about that one?
Yes, ma'am. LRB 1441/1 authorizes a tribal college or a tribal government or one or more tribal governments to initiate a charter school.
Okay. Any questions from committee members? Okay, then we'll take a motion on LRB 1441/1. Is there a motion to approve forwarding that? Senator Gudix, seconded by Senator Weingard. Discussion, comments, questions? Would the clerk please call the roll?
Co-Chair Lozick?
Aye.
Co-Chair Bolling?
Aye.
Senators Fitzgerald? Aye. Gudix?
Aye.
Moulton?
Aye.
Risser?
Aye.
Schilling? Weingard?
Aye.
Representatives August?
Aye.
Barca?
No.
Knodel?
Aye.
Mason?
No.
Murtha?
Aye.
Shanklin?
No.
And Voss?
We have 10 ayes and 4 noes. That one does not move forward. But again, thank you for your work. We really appreciate the tedious time-consuming work that you and all committee members did provide. Thank you. Okay, moving on to our next agenda item. It is an informational report from the Study Committee on the Review of Wisconsin Technical College System Funding and Governance. A vote will not be necessary. Representative John Nygren chaired that, and today he is out of the building conducting a Finance Committee public hearing for the budget. But we do have with us Mary Mathias and Dan Schmidt from the legislative. Oh, you're not?
No.
I thought they were going to brief us. Pardon me. I'm misinformed. Okay, so we have a submitted report available to us. Again, there weren't any recommendations, so a vote won't be required there. So we will move on to the next agenda item, which is adjournment. And we are adjourned.
Sorry about that miscommunication.